My book, The Spirit of Work, Timeless Wisdom, Current Realities, is now published. By interweaving science, business, and sacred texts from the world's great spiritual traditions, The Spirit of Work offers a high-level but approachable way to view and structure work from individual, community, and institutional perspectives. As part of the book's reach and outreach, I will be adding some solo podcasts and interviews with authors who write to build healthy workplaces. To give you a taste of how the book's concepts can enhance your workplace experience, to get to the Spirit of Work links and purchase from online stores directly, click on the online store of your choice from my website, which is shiftworkplace.com/thespiritofwork. Make sure you put hyphens in between the words The Spirit of Work to ensure the correct URL comes up. So that's shiftworkplace.com/thespiritofwork with hyphens. And that's how you'll get to your goal. Looking forward to your feedback. Hello, Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners. Today, I'm really excited to present to you Paul Glover, who is the No BS Workplace Development Coach, and for the past 30 years has been assisting leaders and their organizations to achieve their full potential. Paul is a passionate storyteller who believes in the power of narrative to influence and educate in business, personal life, and even courtrooms. He's a member of the Forbes Council and author of Workquake, a playbook for leaders who want to navigate the future of work beyond traditional command and control models to more inclusive, engaging environments. And just before this interview, he also told me he is a recovering lawyer and an ex-felon, which I'm certainly going to ask him about. So welcome, Paul.
Thank you so much, Marie. It's very nice to be here talking to you and your audience.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to join the audience of Culture and Leadership Connections. Please tell the audience a little bit about who you are and what you do. Give me a more personal introduction than what I just read.
Absolutely. I'm a legacy coach that works exclusively with C-suite executives. Legacy to me is a different approach to coaching. It is more long-term and based on developing skill sets and working with the executives that are building their legacy individually and for their teams and organizations. So it's a more of a long-term commitment between myself and my clients. And that's what I do. It is how I build. By the way, people ask me often, what do I get out of this? And part of the process is I build my legacy, as I believe most coaches do, through their clients. So clearly, by not being a lawyer anymore, you made the comment that I'm a recovering lawyer. I no longer practice law. And so when I got out of prison, I made some decisions about what I was going to do with the rest of my life that would be helping others, something that I was not prone to do before I went to prison. So I decided that with my experience, both as a trial lawyer in federal court, but also as someone who had experienced failure and was engaged with resilience, that I had a skill set that would be useful as a coach. And I started seeking out specific clients who, again, were interested in long-term improvement and legacy. So that is, in a nutshell, maybe a few too many words, but that's what I do.
Well, I love this idea of being a legacy coach, and I'm really curious to find out how you ended up getting into prison and then how you transitioned out of that into someone with high integrity and a code of ethics that you follow and this whole idea of a trajectory of a life that is worth living and that is worth remembering. So how did that happen?
Well, as a lawyer, especially a trial lawyer in federal court, you survive the environment by having a huge ego. And the huge ego was one of my blind spots. And I believe that every individual has blind spots. Leaders usually have more than a few. I definitely had mine. And the blind spots that I had led me to engage with a group that I wanted to belong to. I was an adrenaline junkie. Most trial attorneys are adrenaline junkies. And between trials, you can very quickly become bored in preparation mode. So because of the clientele that I had, there were a lot of undesirables. And I was a bad guy wannabe. I was caught up in the adrenaline portion of the relationship with people who were bad choices for me. And the initiation fee for belonging to that club was to engage in illegal activities. And I did. And that was my responsibility, by the way. But these individuals very quickly recognized my blind spots and that need to belong and need for approval. And they also knew what would trigger me so that they could get me to do what they wanted me to do to their benefit. I was charged with 33 counts of federal crimes, indicted on 33 counts, and found guilty and sentenced to 7 years in federal prison. And I served 5.5 years, a good time. And during that period of time, I went through a transition. First, I'm a very slow learner, and I don't recommend that anyone go to prison to do self-reflection. But that's what it took for me. I was not self-reflective. I also was self-centered. And I lived my life believing that I was the smartest guy in the room, and the rules didn't apply to me. And so, of course, I lost both those opportunities to believe that I was that smart and that the rules didn't apply to me when I went to prison. I spent the first two years of my incarceration engaging in fantasy revenge because I would not accept the fact that I was responsible for going to prison. So I was going to get even with everyone who put me in prison. About year two, I had a revelation based on my experience watching people who I knew when I first started my incarceration period, who left and within that two-year period came back. And the realization suddenly struck me that if I did not change, transform, that's what was going to happen to me. I was going to serve my sentence, get out, be the same person, engage in the same or similar activities, and return to prison. And I decided that wasn't going to be my life. And so I went through a period of self-reflection. And I don't believe that you can do adequate self-reflection on your own. I actually believe you have to have people who care for you and who you respect give you the gift of truth. I started asking my wife and my close friends to do exactly that, to tell me the truth about me. And by the way, for anyone who's gone through that, it's not a pleasant experience.
No, especially if you're not used to it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Can I interrupt to just ask you a question?
Of course.
This club to which you refer, you're not talking about organized crime, are you?
I am talking about the peripheries of that.
I see. Because I was just thinking, if it were organized crime, you may never get out alive. So, and you're still alive, very much so.
Well, I did so. And to tell you how strong the blind spots are, when I was standing in front of the judge who was going to sentence me to a term in prison, he offered me the opportunity to reduce my sentence by 18 months. So I'm serving a 7-year sentence. So he's giving me approximately a 20% reduction in jail time. And he said the only thing that I had to do was to first accept accountability for my crimes. And I'd already been found guilty of these. It's not like the trial was coming up. It was over. I was going to prison. And the second thing was that I would have to cooperate with the government to help them indict and find guilty the co-conspirators. And I refused on both counts. I wouldn't accept accountability, and I certainly would not be an informer. So my blind spots were that strong, and I accepted an additional 20% of prison time rather than admit that I was wrong.
You are really truthful with yourself.
That's the requirement. You know, and I don't compare myself to people who have addictions, except for the fact that there are some similarities. And the similarity is that if you can't be truthful with your own issues, you can't recover from them. You can't combat them because your blind spots don't go away. You just have to understand what triggers them, and you have to be prepared to not allow that to happen. And so I found that the only way it works for me is exactly what you said. I have to be as transparent, authentic, and as vulnerable as possible to make sure that I don't engage in bad behavior and bad choices. Also, I think that that's a skill set for me when I deal with leaders. Leaders often have problems with doing exactly what I'm doing right now, being truthful, authentic, and vulnerable. And that is a part of the coaching process from my perspective. If you can't do that, I don't believe you deserve to be a leader.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. This is great. Really interesting to hear you say this. There is a certain edge to being truthful with yourself that when you've been through something really difficult, it gives you an advantage that others don't have.
And that's why the title that I use is the No BS Workplace Legacy Coach. I will not tolerate bullshit in my life. I won't give it and I won't accept it. And being a trial lawyer, you practice law in front of a jury with clients, and you develop a very attuned bullshit meter.
Yeah.
It's very difficult for someone, and not that it's impossible. I wish I could tell you that I'm so good nobody ever cons me. But the reality is I hung around with con guys, and I can recognize BS. And in the coaching process, there's no room for that.
Right, right. I can see you doing that with people. How do you help them feel safe to explore that so that they're willing to be vulnerable? Because typically, if people don't feel safe, if they feel threatened, they're just going to shut down and refuse to accept vulnerability.
I tell people that I tell them about me first and how flawed I am. So when someone says, well, you know, I'm not sure I can do this, I say, well, you can absolutely do it because I'm doing it in our relationship. And one of my clients described me as a Sherpa. He said, Paul will help guide you to the mountaintop, but he's not going to carry your pack. So that's pretty much the relationship, is that I want people to succeed. I want people to improve, and I want to help them do that. And the relationship, though, is based from my perspective on trust and commitment to each other in the process. And so as long as we start off with that as our ground rules, then we trust each other by being willing to not only tell the truth, but accept the truth.
Well, when Brené Brown was working with a group of people, I forget exactly what the context was, but one of the people in the group said to her, the only reason we're trusting you to go through this with us is because you're just as bad as we are.
By the way, there's something to be said for that, because I had a lot of the tendencies of a CEO. First, I would never tell someone I didn't know the answer. It just couldn't come out of my mouth. I could never tell someone I was wrong. And that to me is a couple of things that CEOs, C-suite leaders need to be able to do. And that's sometimes it's the hardest thing for them to do, to tell someone they don't know, because they look at that as a weakness. And I don't believe that that's the case. And so with myself as the example, leaders have a tendency to open up to me.
Yeah, I could definitely see that happening. So let me ask you a little bit about your childhood. Are there a couple of incidents from your childhood and maybe early adolescence that you believe made you into the person you are today?
Absolutely. I think that we are a combination of personality and experiences. And I also don't believe that personality is malleable. I grew up in a broken home. But the time that I spent with my father, I recognized that he was someone who did not believe that the rules applied to him. He was a big, strong guy, and he did what he wanted to do. And some of the things that he did clearly fell on the other side of being legal. And so, yeah, my model was a very strong male who figured out that he was going to live life his way, regardless of the damage that he caused. And so, unfortunately, that stuck with me. And I believe that that's a part of my growing up experience, and influenced how I looked at life and how I interacted with others.
Is there a specific incident that you can recall?
Well, I can. He had taken me along with him, and he worked for General Motors, and there was a strike going on. And so in the middle of the night, he woke me up specifically to go with him and said, we're going to go participate in the strike activities to convince the company that they should end the strike and give us the wage increase that we want. And so I went with him in the truck, and we drove to a place where there were company vehicles, and he proceeded to destroy them. And got back in the truck and said, that'll teach him. And we went back home.
Ah, and he woke you up so that you could witness it and copy it.
Absolutely. He thought this was a lesson for me. He wanted me to learn it.
Interesting. That would certainly form your character in a way that you would regret later.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anyway, yes, that is a part of my upbringing. And by the way, I loved him, obviously, and I craved his approval and his affection. And I got it, but I also got it because I accepted him and his behavior for what he was.
Yeah, you had to do things on his terms.
Absolutely.
That's a mistake many parents make.
Everyone says the words that they know how formative parenting is, but the reality is we often forget that when we realize or don't realize that our children are watching us 24/7. And they're looking at everything we do and how we do it and what we say about it and how we say it. They're like a sponge. They're soaking that in. And at some point, it becomes a part of who they are.
And they have no filters to decide if something is good or bad or in between. They just absorb it all.
I believe, first, you're absolutely correct. And second, it's all about approval and belonging and acceptance. And when you realize this is how you have to be or how you should be if you want that, then that's what you do. And I grew up with that same level of need that suddenly was filled by other people who committed bad things and said, if you want to belong to our club, if you want to be accepted by us, you have to, this is the initiation fee.
Yeah, and you were already used to that.
Sure. I was like, of course.
Now, what about as an adolescent or young adult? Do you have an incident that you can bring to mind?
I can bring up one. My mother and father separated, and my mom took us to Florida, my sister and I. And I was a pretty good student, and we were poor. She was a waitress, and we got by, but, you know, it was frugal at times. And because of my grades, they decided that that I could move to a different high school, a preferred high school. And, of course, I was completely out of step with the students who were there. I was the poor kid, and the people who went to the school were the rich kids. And the second day, I was approached by a few of the rich kids who made it clear that I didn't belong there. And I can remember this distinctly. It's interesting. You triggered that memory. I haven't thought about this in a long time. I was actually at a locker, and I was taking out a history book, which was pretty hefty. And when this one kid who was the spokesperson told me that I didn't belong there and I needed to leave, I turned around and I hit him in the face with the history book, and bloodied, didn't break his nose, but bloodied his nose. And of course, that immediately got me expelled. But that was how I was taught to react to that. And so that was just a continuation and an enforcement of the fact that the establishment, the people who made the rules, and I were not going to get along.
Yeah, so you were going to just do your own thing and do it in your own way.
Absolutely. That was one of those things that enforced what my dad had already said. You know, that the establishment was the enemy, and that you had to make some decisions. If you weren't going to be a part of the establishment, then you had to figure out what to do so you could survive in spite of the establishment.
Yeah, that really puts you into polarized positions all the time.
Absolutely. You can't escape it.
No, there's no way around it because there aren't any nuances. So you were born into a family and a place, a culture, into a nation. Which of those different groups that you were just born into by accident, you think have influenced you the most?
I think that we weren't poor to the point of being desperate. I mean, we were clothed, we were fed, we had a house that my mother worked hard at. But the reality is that it was pretty apparent at that point that it was going to be, life was going to be a struggle. And you had to make decisions about how you were going to live that life if you were to get the most out of it. And that nothing was going to be given to you, and nothing was going to be given to you easily. And in fact, you would probably have to force yourself into situations that people were not going to open the door. So I guess culturally it felt that way. And maybe that's a lower economic culture. It also in Florida at that time was still segregated. And I can remember being very bitter about segregation, that it offended me. And my mother had a maid that would come over every couple of weeks. And I recall taking her home. And I was driving, and we stopped at a drive-in restaurant, and they wouldn't serve her. And we're still sitting in the car. It wasn't like we got to go in. We ordered, you know, as an outside, and the waitress who came out said, no, we won't serve you. Said, well, we can give you your food, but she's not going to get any food here. And I can remember just being so offended by that and so upset and mad. And so that was, that was obviously, once again, looking at the establishment saying, that's how you treat people. That's not how you're going to treat me.
You developed a keen sense of fairness and justice together with a kind of, I'm going to do it my way, whether other people like it or not, which is an interesting dichotomy.
Yeah, becoming a lawyer is a weird way to go. I don't know that's the one, that's the pivot that I don't think I anticipated, but it appealed to me. And I also thought, well, that gives me the opportunity to be able to oppose in a way that that is different, maybe change the law, represent people who, and obviously I represented people who had broken the law, but representing them was an act of defiance.
I can definitely see that. It was an act of defiance. It was also almost like a Robin Hood kind of approach, you know, trying to take from the rich and give to the poor kind of.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, I didn't represent corporations or businesses. Believe me, I represented those that were exactly the opposite of that. So it was interesting to me, and it depends on which lawyer you talk to, but I thought that trial work was the closest thing to hand-to-hand combat that's legal.
Interesting.
Because you have a referee, but the rules are made to be bent in court. You obviously have someone who gets to say when you are violating one of the rules. But the other attorney is usually an adversary that's worthy, a worthy opponent in federal court. And you also had a jury and the opportunity to convince the jury that you were right and they were wrong. Or the other side was wrong, was a part of the joy. That was the test to be able to win, and I savored that
like a sport.
Absolutely, it was.
So that brings me to my question about the groups that you became a part of. Obviously, you became a part of the lawyer culture, and you had some identification with that. You might like to speak about that some more. But what other groups did you, as an adult, more consciously move towards and have influenced who you are now?
First, marrying and having children was a life-changing event for me. As I stated earlier, my home life, my upbringing was chaotic at best. And even though I had a stable figure with my stepmother, most of my upbringing was done with my mother, and she was chaotic and dysfunctional a lot, even though she worked hard. So, you know, getting married to a woman that I loved and still do, we've been married 40 years now, and having two children clearly was a defining moment. And I was very capable and did silo my lives. I was a respected member of the community, a member of the school board, went to all of the high school sports games with my children, made sure that I was at every game, was a father and a family man and a respected community member. That was the light side of my life. The dark side of my life was how I made a living and who I associated with in that context.
And you decided ultimately that you wanted to increase the light side of your life.
Oh, absolutely. It was a question. And when you say decide, yeah, I tell people that even though I can be an idiot, I'm not stupid. And at some point I came to the realization that first, prison saved my life. If I had not gone to prison, we would not be talking today. I would have been dead for a long time. I truly believe that.
Is there anything about prison life that you think you've kept?
That I kept.
Yeah, kept as part of who you are. It was a significant amount of time in your life.
Oh, it was. But I don't believe there was anything. It's an interesting because, again, the questions, the provocative questions you're asking provoke a memory. I was given an early release, took my case to the Supreme Court and got a reduction in time. And I'd already served enough time, so I was going to have an immediate release. I was transported back to Chicago and we went before the sentencing judge and he gave me immediate release on the spot. And we were then walking in downtown Chicago to the probation office to sign in and let them know that I was now going to be reporting to the probation office on a monthly basis. It was June 1st, 2001, and we're walking a beautiful sunny day. And of course, it's Chicago in 2001. The streets are crowded and we're walking. And I noticed that my wife is very nervous and she's looking at me periodically with concern. And so after about two blocks, I said, so what's going on here? Why are you feeling this way? She said, because I'm afraid that you'll have a collapse. I mean, you've been in prison for 5 years and now you're out and you're in the middle of Chicago and all this chaos and noise and people around you. And this is, so I'm afraid it's going to have an adverse impact. And I said, sweetie, prison was the nightmare. This is my life. And that was it. The transition back was as seamless as I just stated. Did I take anything with me from prison? Nothing. It was an experience that I survived. It did not teach me anything about myself, except for the opportunity to be self-reflective.
Yeah, and maybe to decide that you didn't want that and you didn't want to be that way. And the things around you that were the nightmare you wanted to eliminate.
Well, the consequences became clearer in prison. even though it took me 2 years to see them that way. But it was the recidivism of people who had not transformed or changed were coming back to prison, because that's what happens. When you think about 80% recidivism, this is all because people who are experiencing prison, first, they don't fear it. And second, when they get out, the environment that they return to is conducive to continuing to commit those illegal acts that either get them killed or incarcerated again.
Right. They go back into the same ecosystem.
They do. I decided, no, that wasn't going to happen. And when I got back home after a few weeks, I got a call from someone who said, listen, you're a stand-up guy, and we want to give you some opportunities, financial opportunities. And I said, respectfully, don't want them. And at this time, trying to get a job when you are in your 50s and a ex-felon is extraordinarily difficult. And I could not find work. I had actually filled out a application for Starbucks to become a barista when I got my first client. And at that point, I was able, my wife was working, and we managed to make it until I started to develop a client base and a career.
Your wife really believed in you.
She did. Yeah, she's backbone of steel. I love her dearly. She is my my true north.
She saw you for who you were and for who you could become, and she was willing to go along for the ride.
And believe me, the concept of somebody waiting for you for 5.5 years of incarceration. Once a month, she would drive 5 hours to Southern Illinois to spend 2 days in a crowded, hot visiting room with me. And yeah, that's the type of commitment she had to the relationship. You know, and we had had that discussion when I knew I was going away. I said, my position was, anytime you need to cut me loose, you need to do it. And she made the conscious decision not to do that. So, yes, the fact that I was able to remain a member of our family with her and my two sons is remarkable. And I'm extraordinarily grateful for that.
It's really beautiful. So temperament and personality, you're born with a temperament and personality gets formed along the way. What would you say your temperament was?
Combative, confrontational, aggressive.
High energy, maybe.
Oh, absolutely. Just never stop, never quiet. And also intelligent.
Yeah.
Which is a bad ingredient with the rest of that, by the way, if you're worried about what's going to happen next, because you have a tendency, because of that, easily bored, looking for that adrenaline high all the time, constantly on the move. Those are combustible ingredients that led me to prison.
And what have you added on that has rounded out your personality?
Restraint and a couple of other things besides restraint.
How about integrity? You really sound like you have integrity to me.
I do. And again, I hate the comparison, but I use it anyway. If I were a recovering alcoholic, I would not stop in a bar just to see how strong I was.
No, that's just a bad idea.
It is. And so I've got that same temperament. I will not put myself in a position where I can be tempted. I tell people, you never want to let me be in control of your money. First, I don't want it. And second, I'm not sure what I would do if I was. So no, I avoid temptation. I know that I have got character flaws, and I'm not going to test it. I really am not. The other thing is, yeah, integrity and being able to say that, let me step back. I had no empathy for anyone. Before I went to prison, I had none. And I had no compassion. And I developed those while I was in prison. And I did it on purpose. And I realized that I had to transform. And by the way, my wife was brutal about who I was, because clearly she knows. In fact, I'm trying to get a TEDx talk, and the title of it is Everybody Needs a Fool in Their Life. And my wife, and by the way, the concept of the fool is
the truth teller.
Exactly. Everybody thinks they're an entertainment. They weren't. They were a trusted advisor. And the gift of truth to the king was valuable. That's my wife to me. She was my first fool, and she told me the truth. And then, by the way, I did not take it well. Even though I recognized the truth, I accepting it was extraordinarily difficult. So we did it in small bits. We spent 2 days once a month in the visiting room, and we wouldn't start talking about me until the last half of the second day, because she needed to leave. And I needed to leave so that I could then reflect on what she said without being defensive or doing a knee-jerk reaction back. So I forced myself, and she accepted those conditions, to hear what she had to say without comment or response.
That's the best for everybody to do anyway. That discipline in itself would make the world a much better place to live in.
Absolutely. But yes, and my personality, as well as my adulthood, I went to prison when I was 50. So I was fully formed and, again, thought I was the smartest guy in the room, all of the stuff that we've already talked about. And for me to reverse that and to be able to sit there and take criticism that cut to my core, if it had been anybody else, I wouldn't have happened. But after we went through several months of this, I had gained enough, I guess, composure with hearing it that I then had one of my best friends come down and we went through the same exercise.
Mm-hmm. It sounds very intentional.
Oh, at that point it was. It was a recognition that if I didn't do this, I was not going to make it when I got out. I seriously believe that. I still believe it. That if I had not gone through this experience, that recognition of recidivism and the draw of going back to the way it was, I wouldn't have made it. So it was a determination about survival.
Let me run this by you. You tell me if I'm off. I'm thinking something in your heart and your soul was alive, or you could not have developed it further.
I would agree. I think that everybody's got that. The worst person has got it. The opportunity to have the environment to allow it to blossom, to bloom, to develop is often not there. And if it isn't, it just stays that seed. It does not develop. A prison was that opportunity, that environment for me, of all places, to be able to actually do that self-reflection, to recognize the blind spots and the triggers, and to make some conscious decisions about how I was going to be moving forward, and then embarking on an action plan. And I looked around me at all of the people that were there, most of them young blacks from East St. Louis who were there on drug charges. And prison is very much groups. And it's you normally don't leave your group. I was the old white guy, white collar group. And there was a group of us that banded together. And you don't do a lot of interaction with the other groups. Well, one of the groups was the young blacks from East St. Louis. And I decided that I was going to interact with them. And the way that I did it was I volunteered to teach the GED course. And all of the students were young blacks from East St. Louis.
Sorry, what is GED?
The GED is the equivalent to a high school diploma. Mm-hmm. You get it by going through a course and then passing a test. And so prison offers those without a high school diploma the opportunity to get one. In fact, they force people who don't have it into a program.
Because you don't have any opportunities if you don't have at least a high school diploma.
Absolutely. By the way, rehabilitation is a lost term in the prison system. The government stopped using it. It's warehousing. That's all you're doing. Everybody's warehoused, and then you go home, and hopefully you don't come back. But the reality is you do. So one of the few programs left was the GED program. And I decided I was going to teach GED. And of course, the young men who were forced into this program did not want to be there. And so developing an opportunity to actually impact them in a positive way and teach them something that they could take with them and get them that diploma became one of my goals.
And do you think they taught you something?
Oh, absolutely. And they were not, here they are, you know, they're used to somebody who is not interested in them, but they have to be there and listen to. And I said, I'm going to find out about these young men. And I'm going to do this through, I've actually developed this. I call it being perpetually curious and being empathetic in my interaction.
Those are two criteria for cultural competency.
Yeah, absolutely. And therefore, by being that open with this group, they responded. Because they never had anybody, I don't believe, they certainly never had an old white guy sitting up there saying, hey, I really want to know about you.
And but, being sincere about it.
Absolutely, being authentic.
Yeah.
And it took a while, because why would they trust me?
Exactly.
And yet it worked. And I started to have some impact, some positive impact on some of them. Obviously, I wish I could tell you that everybody went through the course, went home and became Martin Luther King, but that's not what happened. But there were some that I was able to help, to assist, make sure that they got some education. And that became fulfilling.
And what do you think you learned from them, from that experience?
Well, I think that I learned that they did not have the opportunities that I did. And it embarrassed me for me to think that I had squandered mine.
Oh, yes. That's a good point.
Yeah, it was. It was humbling.
Very.
And I had to work through that about all of the opportunities that I had. And by the way, I felt, you know, I worked in college working in a warehouse at night. I went to law school, paid my own way. I mean, I didn't ask for anything, but I still had the opportunity for a variety of reasons. And I was able to get that law degree. And that was something that I squandered, absolutely squandered. And the devastating impact that had on my family, as well as my career. I can never practice law again. I love practicing law. But I used it in the wrong way, and I squandered it. And we're struggling to earn a living, standing on a corner selling drugs. And they did not have that opportunity. It wasn't offered to them. So it was a humbling experience.
This realization of the sacredness of the human spirit, how important it is for each of us to be able to attain to some degree our potential. What you're just saying just made me think of that.
And I think that's a very astute observation. I would agree with that. And I think so many of us have to understand how grateful we should be for what we have. That's one thing that I never was. I never had enough. I was always entitled to more, and I was going to get more because I was entitled to it. And if that meant stealing it from somebody, then that was okay with me because I was entitled to do that. And I start my day off now, and I recommend this to all the people who are in my coaching program, by doing my gratitudes.
That's the remedy to being entitlement is gratitude. If you want to switch stuff around, practicing gratitude is going to start bringing you into that place of humility and appreciation.
And we don't remind ourselves of that because we have to. It's so easy to think that we're not being given our due or that we need more. And when you start listing how much you have to be grateful for, I believe it changes your mind. It is a positive approach to every day, but it also is a mindset changer. And it's so simple to do. I've got a list of 200 right now, and most of those are people. And I'll go through, I do five a day.
Well, I am grateful to have met you because you're really opening a lot of, I think, opportunities for people to think differently and to experience life in a really authentic, present way, which brings me to my next question.
Sure.
but did you want to comment on that?
Well, I was going to say, and if you don't realize that, we are such a nation of dissatisfaction. It is extraordinary to me how dissatisfied we are living in what's recognized as the best country for opportunities in the world. Not to say that there aren't difficulties and things that are wrong. But the concept of being this dissatisfied with our lives is disturbing. And that's because we won't look at what we have. We look at what we don't have.
I so completely agree with you on that. And the more we look at what we have, the more it grows, because what you pay attention to grows. And if you keep thinking, I have nothing, well, then you just increase the void.
Yeah.
Can you recall a time when, and you've been talking about a lot of them already, but you felt that your understanding of the world was specific to you and your culture and not the norm?
Well, I do think that I've already gone over that.
In many ways, really.
Obviously, I did go through a transformation about how I was looking at life, specifically about how I was living life. And I came to, you know, one of those things about being so self-centered is that you don't pay attention to the damage you're doing to others.
But what I'm talking about is more of a group thing. It's like recognizing that you do belong to some group or some way of living and experience that is specific to that group.
No. You know, I grew up a loner and I remain a loner, but I will join for a cause. I'm very much cause oriented. And if there's a cause that I can connect to, then I will join that cause. But as far as having a group that I look at and say, that's who I'm a part of, I'm not.
No, but did you feel any sense of dissonance when you went to prison? Or did you feel like, oh, yeah, this is the way, I just belong here?
No, actually, I said, this is something that I will survive.
Yeah, that must have been a moment of cultural dissonance for you.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. Just to give you another example, as soon as I checked in and I self-surrendered, and it was the afternoon and went through the process of being inducted into prison, which means you give up your civilian clothes. They give you your prison clothes. And when I went to the area to get those prison clothes, the guard who was there said, well, I've been told to give you a full body cavity search. And I was like, okay, this is going to be a pleasant experience. He said, and I said, so this is normal routine, right? He said, no, this is just for you. He said, you're a lawyer, and the warden believes that lawyers are troublemakers in this system. So he wants to make sure that you understand that if you cause any trouble, life is really going to get hard for you. So I go through this embarrassing, but by the way, at some point you stop being embarrassed. I mean, this is, you're in prison for the love of Pete. So I get through with that, got my prison clothes on, and the clerk, law clerk, came and got me, and he said, the warden wants to talk to you. So go to the warden's office, knock on the door, enter, walk in, shut the door. Now, his head's down. He's writing on a piece of paper. There's a chair in front of his desk. So I stood there for a few seconds, maybe a couple of moments, but I sat down. And he didn't raise his head. He said, who told you you could sit down? Stand up. And he said, if you cause any trouble, I'm going to put you in the hole for 90 days and then ship you to a higher security level institution. Just to make sure you understand, you're not running anything here.
I have to say, this is the best story of cultural dissonance I've ever heard. I wish I had a prize for you.
Well, and by the way, I knew enough guys who'd gone to prison, and I told him what I truly believed. I will not do anything that makes my time any longer or any harder. And that was my my credo. But that was my first encounter with the system, right? Yeah, we don't like you. We don't like you being here. We don't like you, period. And therefore, don't ever cause any trouble. And by the way, there were some guards who took particular delight in tormenting me.
I'm sure they did.
Oh, absolutely. One in particular, you're asleep at night. You've got a locker, and this guard who would go through, and they do count, which means periodically, every 2 or 3 hours, they come and they count to make sure everybody's still in their bunk. No one's escaped. And so it would be 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock. And this one guy, when he was on duty, would come to my bunk in my cell, and he would beat on my locker with his billy club.
That's loud.
And wake me up, you know, make me set up in bed so he can see me. And then he would dump all of my belongings out on the floor and say, it should be 1 o'clock in the morning. And he would say, I expect you to clean this mess up before I get back at 3. I'd get out, because obviously you have a choice. You can do this or you can not and go to the hole. And like you said, I'm not making my time any longer, any harder. He would leave. I would put my stuff back in the locker. 3 o'clock, we would do this experience again. And we would do it 1, 3, and 5. And he was on duty probably once every quarter. He would show up. That's just the way it is. And tough lesson, by the way, because my first inclination, of course, was I'm not going to tolerate that.
Yeah.
And the reality is,
they didn't have a choice.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you do. You always have a choice.
Yeah, but you had the choice to suck it up and get out of prison earlier, or fight and stay there longer.
This would be a tilting of windmills, and I've never done that. I've always had a purpose, a goal, something that I was working towards. And this was training for me.
So, Paul, what's the best way for clients to work with you? What makes it a good fit for you and a client?
We get to some very basic levels. First, the level of trust. I don't believe any relationship works without it. And it has to be trust by the fact of being authentic and vulnerable with each other and open. And then a commitment to the process, because I don't believe I went through it. I can tell leaders that if you are seriously wanting to change, to transform, to create legacy, this is a hard journey, and you must commit to doing the hard work. And that is where most clients find out pretty quickly that they don't want to work with me. I probably work with 20% of the clients that initially approach me, because they're not willing to climb the mountain and carry their own pack. And once they find out that I'm not going to carry their pack, and I'm also going to hold them accountable, because they'll tell me what they want to accomplish. If it's not enough, I'll tell them that. And that's an odd thing for them to hear, but I'll tell them why it's not enough, because we're not talking. Listen, if you need someone to teach you to be a better public speaker, I'm not the person to talk to. Find a speaking coach. If you're talking about legacy, which is the creation of something that lasts after you're gone, I'm your guy because I will work hard. As hard as you work, I will work to make sure that happens.
So that kind of brings me to my question about what would you like to promote? Is it your coaching services you would like to promote? Here's your soapbox moment. What would you like to say?
Well, I tell people it's always referral. Anyone who thinks that they would like to enter into a coaching relationship, I welcome the opportunity to have that discussion. They can contact me at paulglovercoaching.com. The email is paul@paulglovercoaching.com. But that's it. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss these things with someone who asks the provocative and thoughtful questions that you ask, because I do believe that I've got a message and I'm more interested in people hearing the message than I am at promoting my services. Not that I don't want to promote my services, but that's not the purpose of me being on this podcast. I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate the thoughtful, interesting questions, because you obviously have cause me to think about and give you what I hope are answers that other people can relate to and perhaps benefit from.
I think they will. Everybody comes to it in their own way. But when people are really honest about their lives, it makes for a really transformative listening experience. And I appreciate you doing that. I really do. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we end the...
Well, there is. I'm trying to get this TED Talk. And if I do, I am going to ask everybody who has had me on as a podcast guest to look at the TED Talk.
Oh, I'd be happy to.
And it is this message. They're talking about how they need a fool in their life, just like I did. Otherwise, I don't believe that you can transform. But second, the obligation then is to become a fool for someone. And I think that that's important. It's an important message for people to hear, because it's a necessary message. And it also not only transforms them, but allows them to engage in helping someone else transform.
Yes, for sure. That's what we're all here for. Help each other transform.
That's how it works, if it's going to work.
Yes, for sure. Paul, thank you so much for this really insightful interview and for your wonderful responses. I appreciate very much having heard from you, and I look forward to seeing your TED Talk.
Thank you, Maria. I appreciate the opportunity to have the discussion with you and with your audience.
Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you. You also.
Paul Glover is a man with a story, and he tells his life in a way that leaves both an indelible mark on the listener and a lasting legacy. I was impressed with Paul's honesty and transparency. His fascinating journey from lawyer to felon and from prison to civilian life shows how he used 5 years of reflection to tame his personal demons into skill sets. The transformation from manipulation, command, and control to inclusive and supportive leadership coaching was made possible, ultimately, through the anchoring love of his wife and sons, where he found the sense of belonging that had eluded him previously. I hope you enjoyed this interview on the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast, and I would love it if you share the episode with others to help us reach our listener goal of 1,000 downloads per episode. Thank you for listening, and may Culture and Leadership Connections continue to guide and inspire your day. Hey, podcast listeners, help us reach our goal of 1,000 downloads per episode by going to followthepodcast.com/cultureandleadership. That's followthepodcast.com/cultureandleadership. If you type that into your browser and you use the and sign, not the word and, culture and leadership, it will automatically adjust to your phone, and then you can follow and rate. So followthepodcast.com/cultureandleadership. Thanks in advance for following and for reviewing.